This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
It was Christmas 45 years ago. Sympathetic deputies transformed the jail in Henry County, Illinois, into a sanctuary for a destitute mother, Hilda Cron, and her family. But within weeks, the simple act of charity would backfire when 7 of Hilda's 9 children were separated and put up for adoption. Barbara Pasiak was thrilled when her daughter Paula brought her boyfriend home for a visit. 5 days later, Paula was dead, and the boyfriend was on the run, suspected of murder. Also one of the most fascinating mysteries of this century, the story of Anastasia, youngest daughter of the last Tsar of Russia. History records that she was executed along with the rest of her family by Bolshevik revolutionaries in 1918. But evidence abounds that history may be wrong. In the 1920s, a mysterious woman turned up in Germany using the name Anna Anderson and claiming that she was Anastasia. For more than 70 years, the secret of Anna Anderson's true identity has provoked a tantalizing and often fiery debate. Join me as we journey to Russia on this very special edition of Unsolved Mysteries. Her name was Anastasia. She was more royal than a princess. She was an imperial Grand Duchess of Russia, daughter of Tsar Nicholas II, the wealthiest man in the world. Anastasia was born with her father's captivating azure blue eyes. But the Tsar already had 3 daughters. He, along with all of Russia, wanted a boy, an heir to the throne. Anastasia must have sensed that she was a disappointment. She grew into an unrepentant tomboy, a jokester, the family clown. Even after her son was finally born, Anastasia remained the rebel of the Imperial Romanov family. Her impish nature was irrepressible, whether she was roller skating on the decks of the Imperial yacht or enduring the pomp and panoply of the Russian court. Then on July 17, 1918, Anastasia's fairy tale life came to a horrible end. She was just 17 when her entire family was executed, along with her physician and 3 servants. Their burial site remained a dark state secret. As far as history was concerned, that was the end of Anastasia and her family. 19 months later, a young woman, nameless and alone, wandered the gloomy, damp streets of Berlin, Germany. When she came to Bendler Bridge, spanning a murky city canal, the stage was set for one of the world's great mysteries.
Stop!
Eventually, the young woman would take the name Anna Anderson and shock the world by claiming that she was the Grand Duchess Anastasia. The debate over her identity rages to this day.
There is absolutely no question in my mind at all that the Grand Duchess Anastasia survived the assassination of the Romanovs in 1918, made it to the West, and died in the United States as Anna Anderson. No question at all.
Despite adamant opinions on both sides, it seemed this was a mystery which would never be solved. Then on July 12, 1991, in this remote field near the Siberian city of Ekaterinburg, Russia, the remains of the Tsar's family were finally unearthed. To the astonishment of almost everyone, two bodies were missing from the grave, and one was Anastasia's. Now, using sophisticated DNA technology, scientists may finally be able to answer once and for all the question that has haunted history for nearly 75 years. Was Anna Anderson, in fact, the Grand Duchess Anastasia, whose name means she who is reborn? Nicholas II, fated to be the last Tsar of Russia. In the beginning, his life was the envy of the world. An adoring wife of royal blood, Alexandra, granddaughter of Queen Victoria of England. Four beautiful daughters, the Grand Duchesses Olga, Tatiana, Marie, and Anastasia. And finally, a son, Alexei, heir to the throne. Alexei, however, was a hemophiliac. His disease was kept a tightly held family secret, and the seven Romanovs drew more and more into themselves. Even their closest relatives saw little of them. But while the Romanovs lived in grand and increasingly isolated opulence, most of their subjects were starving. When Nicholas involved his country in World War I, hundreds of thousands of his soldiers had neither shoes nor rifles. More than a million men were killed or wounded. Finally, the people rebelled. In 1917, Nicholas abdicated to a provisional democratic government, but soon after, that government fell to the radical Bolsheviks. The Tsar's mother and sisters made it safely out of the country, but the Tsar, his wife and children, were virtual prisoners in their own palace. On August 13, 1917, the Romanovs were banished in the dead of night from the summer palace just outside St. Petersburg. 11 months later, the entire family was executed, or so it was thought, until the mysterious young woman appeared in Germany on February 18, 1920.
Please write this way, miss.
After her suicide attempt, police committed the young woman to Dahldorf Asylum, a mental institution just outside Berlin.
You must be responsible.
She gave no information about herself and was dubbed Miss Unknown. Only much later would she take the name Anna Anderson.
This is your bed.
At Dahldorf, she underwent her first physical examination. Doctors discovered that her body was covered with scars for which they could find no explanation.
There is a one.
She began to reveal her own personality very slowly. For many, many months, she virtually never left her bed. And
James Blair Lovell, author of Anastasia, the Lost Princess, knew Anna Anderson personally.
She was, in her mind, in hiding. And the best place to hide was this asylum where no one would come looking for her or suspect that she was who she was.
The patient hid her identity successfully until a woman named Clara Puthart was admitted to the same ward at Dahldorf in December of 1921.
Clara, good morning.
What is it?
I know you.
I don't understand.
What are you talking about?
Oh, it is all right, my daughter. You know, it is such a miracle that you're alive.
Clara Puthart was a devotee, as were so many people then, of Royalty magazines.
Yesterday.
And she began to look at pictures of the Romanovs.
Look at this picture.
And she began to believe that Miss Unknown bore a striking, uncanny resemblance to the Grand Duchess Tatiana.
And then it came to me. It is you.
Miss Unknown neither confirmed nor denied Clara Puthart's claim.
I can see the resemblance.
Soon word reached several members of the Russian nobility exiled in Paris. They sent an official representative, a Madame Tolstoy, to Dahldorf.
We are just here to talk. There's someone I would like for you to meet.
Please go away.
I don't want to see anyone.
Don't be afraid, child. It's just that I spoke with your friend Clara, and she has told me so much about you. I wanted to meet you for myself. My God. She has eyes of Nicholas.
Later, Tolstoy told people that when she saw those eyes, in the context of the rest of the face, she knew she was looking at one of the daughters of the Tsar.
Eventually, Anna Anderson told several nurses she was actually Anastasia, the youngest Grand Duchess. Indeed, she did resemble Anastasia facially and in height and age. Apparently, several childhood scars and birthmarks were checked out, and they too matched. Now the fresh scars seemed to make sense. Perhaps they were remnants of Bolshevik bullets and bayonets. 4 years later, in July of 1925, while the young woman was hospitalized for surgery, she received a visitor. Shura Giard, Anastasia's former nanny, had come to see for herself just who Miss Unknown was. Shura recognized the Grand Duchess, both by her childhood scars and by a bone deformity on her right foot. Then the young woman beckoned to Shura to massage her forehead with cologne. It had been a favorite childhood ritual of Anastasia's, known only to the two of them. Later, Shura and her husband brought the Tsar's sister Olga to visit. Olga had last seen her niece when Anastasia was a plump, boisterous adolescent more than a decade earlier.
Is it you? My child, you're so pale.
Her aunt said that this young woman had lost so much weight that she was unable to make a positive visual identification of her. And so they talked.
I am so happy.
According to Anastasia, Olga then did say, "You are my niece. I recognize you.
We shall not abandon you. This is such a nice hospital."
The next day, in a private visit with Olga, Anastasia made a revelation about the Tsar's secret bank account, which would ultimately prove to be her undoing.
You know, we lost everything when we escaped from Russia.
I don't think you have to worry about me.
Why not?
Because all the money that Nicholas left for us. Your father...
There was, she believed, in the Bank of England, $80 million.
I don't think so.
This was news to the family. And that one conversation, that incident, radically changed the life of Anna Anderson forever.
Anastasia was betrayed. $80 million in 1925 was the equivalent of $5.6 billion in today's economy. It was ample motivation for Anastasia's aunt and the other surviving Romanovs to deny her identity and therefore her right to any of the money. In essence, she was once again Miss Unknown. However, Anastasia was not abandoned by everyone. In 1927, she took up residence in a German castle under the protection of a sympathetic Duke and Duchess. That spring, Gleb Botkin, a close childhood friend of Anastasia's, traveled from his home in the United States to see whether the Grand Duchess had somehow survived. Gleb was the youngest child of the Tsar's physician, Dr. Eugene Botkin. The doctor had been executed along with the imperial family, but Gleb was able to escape from Russia.
One of the childhood games that he and Anastasia had played together was that Gleb would draw or would paint a watercolor painting of animals dressed in human clothing and in human-like situations, give the picture to the young Anastasia, and she then would make up a story to explain the action in the picture.
Вы хотите говорить по-русски?
Нет. But I would like to see the pictures.
Oh, yes.
He recognized her immediately. And as she leafed through them,
she
remembered the stories
I remember
that she had made up years earlier to accompany the pictures.
Telling the rat that they were safe because the cat was caught by a lion.
It was the most significant recognition of Anastasia in her lifetime.
Was about my father.
And Gleb Botkin
yes.
became, as she called
oh,
him, her lifelong champion.
Friends with a lion. And when the
Only later died, would Anna recount for Gleb what she knew about the terrible night of July 17th, 1918. How she had been horribly wounded and rendered unconscious during the execution. How she had been thrown on a truck with the dead bodies of her family. How the truck lumbered off into the night, heading to a secret gravesite. At some point, the truck overheated. A soldier named Alexander Tchaikovsky was one of those left to stand guard. He realized Anastasia was not dead. Aided by his brother, Tchaikovsky spirited her to safety. Alexander Tchaikovsky was later killed in Romania. Anastasia eventually made her way to Germany and Bendler Bridge. Twenty years after the Tsar's assassination, Gleb Botkin and Anna's lawyer were finally able to go to court to claim Anastasia's inheritance and thereby prove Anna Anderson's identity.
That Anna Anderson is the Grand Duchess Anastasia.
During the course of this entire case, the Romanov family...
None of the principals had any idea that the case, including several appeals, would drag on literally for the rest of their lives. From the beginning, Anna's attorneys based their arguments on the numerous points of similarity between the Grand Duchess and Anna Anderson. Experts analyzed photographs of both women's ears. The match impressed even Anna's bitterest enemies. Various scars and birthmarks also matched. Handwriting samples were analyzed and found virtually identical. Anna was now 58 years old. She had become increasingly eccentric and was almost totally uncooperative, both with her own attorneys and with the courts. Anna lived in a remote German village near the Black Forest. Her modest cottage was overgrown with weeds and overrun by her four dogs and 30 cats.
Good afternoon, Miss Anderson.
What is it?
Can I talk to you?
In 1959, during an appeal of the case, a judge and two language experts came to ascertain whether Anna, who almost always spoke German or English, could also speak Russian.
Who are these people?
These are the experts that your attorney agreed upon.
Anastasia refused to allow anyone into her house except the judge.
I never agreed to any such meeting.
And when he extended his hand to shake hers, she refused to do so, saying that she was afraid of germs. In fact, she considered it a breach of etiquette on the part of a lowly German Supreme Court judge to want to shake the hand of a Russian Grand Duchess.
I have made my choices, and I am willing to live with them.
She refused to speak Russian to him.
I don't think you understand.
Was totally social, as if this were just a little tea party. And at the end of 10 minutes, she dismissed him.
But this meeting is over.
Finally, in 1967, the German High Court issued a decision. There was not enough evidence to prove Anna Anderson's claim. The court did state, however, that the death of Grand Duchess Anastasia could not be considered a verifiable historical fact. Despite that small victory, Anna had had enough of lawyers and courts. These home movies of Anna Anderson, televised here for the first time, were shot in Germany in 1967. The following year, Anna moved to Charlottesville, Virginia, where her protector, Gleb Botkin, introduced her to one of his friends. On December 23, 1968, Anna married Jack Manahan, 18 years her junior. 1 year later, Gleb Botkin died, never wavering in his belief that Anna Anderson was Anastasia. In fact, Anna now called herself Anastasia Manahan. She and Jack were a quirky, eccentric couple, the bane of their neighbor's existence. Over the years, Jack's once beautiful house became overgrown and full of cats. Anastasia died in 1984, Jack in 1990. 16 months later, on July 12, 1991, the Imperial family's skeletons were finally exhumed near Ekaterinburg, Russia. After the execution, the bodies had been buried hodgepodge. Still, everyone expected to find all 7 Romanovs, as well as 4 members of the family's entourage.
In the grave, there were supposed to be 11 bodies, but only 9 were there. 2 were missing. For a whole year, we looked for the 2 missing skeletons, but we could never find them.
The middle face has been badly fractured.
In an effort to determine which skeletons were missing, the Russians invited American forensic expert Dr. William Maples to examine the remains.
It's a shame we don't have a good...
We looked at the remains, we photographed the remains, we measured the remains, and for each of the 9 skeletons, we determined age, sex, race. We determined that the Tsar was most likely there, bodied 7 as the Tsarina. We had the family physician, Dr. Botkin, and we had 3 of the daughters. But I don't believe any of the 3 daughters could be young enough to be Anastasia, who was 17 years, 1 month at the time of the shooting.
Also missing were the remains of Alexei, the Tsar's youngest child and only son. It was the absence of Anastasia's body, however, which once again fueled the controversy. Was it possible that Anastasia had somehow managed to escape the carnage?
Whether she could have survived that night, I seriously doubt it. As a forensic scientist looking at the objective evidence that we have, we don't have any evidence that anyone would have survived. The damage to the remains was pretty profound.
The official Bolshevik account is as follows.
Mashenka, просыпайся, дорогой, просыпайся.
The Romanovs were imprisoned in the former home of a wealthy Ekaterinburg industrialist. The Tsar had been ordered by the Bolsheviks to awaken his family. There was unrest in the town, and supposedly, the Romanovs had to be moved for their own protection. The girls were given half an hour to dress. They carefully laced on their corsets. A fortune in precious stones and gems had been sewn into the linings. The Romanovs, along with Gleb Botkin's father and 3 servants, were led into the cellar. They had no way of knowing they were about to die. The Tsarina asked for chairs. 2 were brought. Then abruptly, Yakov Yurovsky, the Bolshevik officer in charge, read the orders of execution.
Ввиду того, что ваши родственники продолжают наступление на Советскую Россию, Уралисполком постановил расстрелять вас.
Что?
Nicholas, dumbfounded, asked him to repeat.
Ввиду того, что ваши родственники продолжают наступление на Советскую Россию, Уралисполком постановил расстрелять вас.
When they began shooting, the bullets bounced off Grand Duchess and returned to them. They did not know that in corsets of Grand Duchess, the Tsarina hid their jewels, and jewels protected them. They decided that God protected them, and they immediately became crazy. And disorder shooting began.
In the first volley of shots, Anastasia was not hit. After everyone else was dead, even the Bolshevik accounts will tell you that Anastasia was alive. One account has her standing up and screaming, while one of the guards stuck a bayonet through one of her feet to pin her to the floor, and the other one clubbed her in the jaw with a rifle butt.
Assuming Anastasia was now dead, Yurovsky's men loaded all the bodies onto a truck. However, en route to the secret burial site, the truck would get bogged in the mud, and Yurovsky would decide to dispose of the bodies on the spot. Yurovsky reported that in order to confuse anyone who might locate the grave, he burned two of the bodies and disposed of the charred remains right there. The other nine, he wrote, were buried together a few meters away. Edvard Rudzinski, author of The Last Tsar, The Life and Death of Nicholas II, believes that Yurovsky simply invented this scenario to cover up the fact that he could not account for all the bodies.
They did not see two bodies when they buried the Romanov in this terrible grave. And Yurovsky had only one opportunity to explain it. He wrote, "We burn two bodies." It was the end.
Not only Anastasia, but two of the other daughters as well were actually alive.
Michael Medvedev, whose father was a member of the execution squad, disagrees.
When the soldier began to move the body from the wall of execution onto some stretchers, the girls regained consciousness and moaned in pain, including Anastasia. And one of the soldiers named Peter Yurmakov, he killed Anastasia.
And so the great riddle continues. Is the body of Grand Duchess Anastasia hidden in a shallow grave near the spot where the rest of her family was found? Or did Anastasia somehow survive the assassination, only to emerge years later as the eccentric Anna Anderson? Many of those who knew Anna best believe the truth is undeniable.
Anna Anderson was Anastasia. All she wanted was for the world to leave her alone and for her surviving family members to publicly acknowledge what they privately acknowledged, and that was simply her identity.
It was December of 1948. Christmas was just around the corner. Annawan, Illinois seemed like a Norman Rockwell painting. Wholesome, peaceful, serene. But while most families were joyfully anticipating the arrival of the holiday season, one couple, Frank and Hilda Kron, were visited by disaster. The Krons were dirt poor and lived with seven of their children in a small farmhouse on the outskirts of town. There was no plumbing or heating, and every night, the children all crammed into a single bed to keep warm.
Yes?
Hello, are you Mrs. Hilda Kron?
Yes, I am.
Is your husband home?
No, I'm sorry, he had to leave early this morning. Why, is something wrong?
Well, yes, ma'am, I'm afraid there is. We have an eviction notice here from your landlord, and I'm afraid we're going to have to ask you and your family to vacate the premises.
Mama, I'm hungry.
Marie, it'll have to wait.
The deputies learned that the Krons had nowhere to go and took pity. They decided they could not let the family spend Christmas out in the cold. In the spirit of the season, they took Hilda and the children to the only available shelter in town, the Henry County Jail. Raymond Kron was 8 years old at the time.
Okay, boys, here we go.
Yeah, they just put us all in a car and to jail we come. It was just a place for us to be in out of the weather. Is what I kind of remember of as being that there was no other place for us. So.
Suddenly the jail was transformed. His cold cement walls were now home for a destitute mother and her seven young children. The boys and girls are free to roam throughout the jail, but in a mystery that is still troubling, their parents were forbidden to see one another.
Well, Dad wasn't allowed to go in to the jail to see Mother, and she wasn't allowed to go out. And I never understood that either. So. Like I say, they let us go wherever we wanted to and do whatever we wanted to.
Can I open the cell?
We used to be able to go outside whenever we wanted to. We used to go down and talk to other prisoners. We used to play with things that we weren't supposed to. But I remember the fun place, you know, because I was only 8 and I didn't know what was really going on.
Is everybody clear?
Yeah.
Marie Cron was 4 years old in 1948. Her memories of jailhouse life are quite different from her brother Raymond's.
One time my mother was giving me a bath and the policemen were walking by.
Good afternoon, ladies.
Hello, Sheriff.
And I got really nervous. I didn't want to be in that tub. Every time then after that it was time for me to take a bath. I didn't want to, because I was afraid these men would walk back by again and see me in that tub.
A week went by, then two. On December 17, 1948, the family's plight was publicized in the local newspaper, which carried this photograph, the only family portrait known to exist. In response, many community members offered assistance. A well-intentioned social worker hoped to brighten the children's Christmas by taking them out of jail and placing them in foster homes for the holidays.
Hello.
Hi.
You must be Francis?
Yes.
And are you Marie? You girls are going to come with me for a little ride.
I remember that Francis and I, neither one wanted to go.
Now, come on. You'll have fun.
We really had never been away from our mother. We had always been, our mother had always been there and everything else. But finally we had to go. I mean, there was no way that we were going to get to stay there. I felt that, she felt that if we went, that we would have at least a nice Christmas, one that we had never actually ever had in our life. And then, like I say, that's the last time we, either one of us saw our mother after that.
While their mother remained behind bars, Marie and Francis were placed in separate homes and eventually adopted. To this day, Marie wonders whether her mother actually consented to give the children away.
Yes, well, come on, we're gonna have to go now. Let's go this way.
Maybe she couldn't read, and if she signed any papers that was giving us away, she didn't know what she was signing, that she was maybe told that she was signing a release form for us, giving her permission for us to go for over the holidays.
Okay, dinner time, boys.
Christmas Day finally arrived.
It's a candy bar.
At the Henry County Jail, it was a day without Santa Claus and stockings, but not completely without Christmas spirit.
The reason why I know it was Christmas time is because when we got our dinner tray, there was a candy bar on it. It made an impression on me because I probably never had anything like that for quite a while. And, or even, you know, anything for Christmas for a while that I remembered of, you know, and this, it did stick in my mind and it always will.
Within a month, Raymond and his brothers Clarence and Leonard would be placed in children's homes. But the fate of their parents, Frank and Hilda Cron, remains a mystery to this day. Marie recalls being told that they had been banished from the state of Illinois.
My adopted mother told me that they were never to return, that if they did, they would be arrested. That I don't, but she never explained why or anything else.
The secrets about her mother and father plagued Marie throughout childhood. She and her sister Frances, now named June, had been adopted by neighboring families, who, for reasons unknown, insisted on keeping the young girls apart.
I remember that one time I went up to the store and Francis was up there at the store. So we walked home together and we talked.
She's the meanest teacher there.
And then her mother came and called her in.
Oh, that's nice.
Come inside now.
I'll be right back.
Okay.
And she told me she'd be back out. And I waited and waited. And then finally I went and knocked on the door and her adopted mother came to the door and says, she can't come out, she has things to do, and then shut the door. And I went home and I was real upset about it.
Years passed. Marie never stopped wondering about her brothers and sisters. Finally, in 1966, Marie learned through a mutual friend that Raymond, whom she had not seen in 18 years, was living in a nearby community.
I remember driving down the street looking for Raymond's house, and then I saw this guy standing on the porch, and I knew right away it was Raymond, and I stopped the car and jumped out and ran up there. It was really wonderful to see him again for after all that time not being together.
Marie!
Raymond! Oh my God!
The minute she got there, I knew she was my sister.
It's called
I knew it was her. And I hadn't seen her for 18 years. And it was a real exciting reunion.
You know, I got a little lost on my way here, but as soon as I saw you on the porch, I knew it was you.
Marie and Raymond spent hours reminiscing and catching up on the years they had spent apart. Together, they vowed to find out what had happened to the rest of their family. For 18 years, Marie and Raymond suffered through a series of near misses and false leads. Finally, in 1993, they did locate one sister, Carol. Then their story aired on Unsolved Mysteries. Incredibly, within a few hours, two more sisters and three brothers had been found. On July 9th, 1994, we were at Raymond's house in Houston, Texas, as the Cron family gathered for their first reunion in more than 45 years. Marie's dream had finally come true.
I've been looking forward to this for a long time because I didn't know if I would ever get to really meet him in person or not.
How you doing?
I feel that the love is, you know, still there. It's it never went away. It's always been there, and I always wondered about him, and now I'll finally get to find out what's been going on with their life and everything and get reacquainted.
For the oldest sister, Betty Jane, the reunion was particularly emotional.
I knew that was Marie right away. Just by looking at her, I knew that was Marie. And that's when the first one I embraced. I was very happy to see them all. And they all start coming to me and I start going to them, hugging them and everything. So I was very happy and I feel good. I really do.
For Raymond, the end of the search meant a new beginning.
I know you're going to get tired of me a week.
No, we won't.
We got a lot of catching up.
Yeah, we do.
I always knew that their names and everything, but I didn't know how to go about finding them or anything. We hunted and we just got turned down every place we turned to try to find them. And then, till this come along and it worked.
When we return, authorities need your help to find a man suspected of killing his girlfriend. Kissimmee, Florida is a lakeside resort town about 10 miles south of Orlando.
Paula. Oh,
honey.
Oh, it is so good to see you.
I am so glad that you're here.
On July 9th, 1986, 22-year-old Paula Pasiak and her boyfriend Jerry Gervasoni arrived from New Jersey to visit Paula's mother, Barbara.
Let's go. Yeah, it is.
They stayed there about 1 week. We all had a good time together. Paula was as happy as a lark. The two of them were. I mean, they were very together. They were just happy-go-lucky.
Thanks for dinner. It was really good, wasn't
yeah.
it, Jerry?
Thank you. Well,
during the visit, well. Paula and Jerry slept in Barbara's bedroom while she slept on a couch.
So, do you guys have any plans for tomorrow, or what?
Well, I was thinking maybe go visit my relatives down in Miami.
On Sunday, four nights after they arrived, Paula and Jerry told Barbara they would be leaving the next morning for a short excursion to another part of Florida.
I'm kind of tired, so
I got up the next morning.
Good night.
And I thought I heard them up. And I didn't know whether they were or not, so I didn't bother to say goodbye. Maybe if I had, things would have been different.
How long has it been this way?
For a couple of days.
Over the next 5 days, an odd smell began to waft through Barbara's mobile home. However, she and a friend were unable to determine where it was coming from.
Trash and the garbage.
Well, on Saturday morning, I got up, and by now the odor had really become strong to the point where I had to search around to see what was causing this.
Barbara searched the entire trailer and found nothing. The last place she looked was in her own bedroom. Hidden under the bed, wrapped in a bamboo curtain, was Paula's body.
At first, I wasn't sure of what I seen. And just didn't expect it. I had to stop and think, is this real or am I seeing things?
Paula Pasiak had been strangled to death and left under the bed for nearly a week. The prime suspect was Jerry Gervasoni, but he had dropped from sight. Less than a month later, authorities got their first break when they questioned a friend of Jerry's. Just 3 days after the murder, he had picked Jerry up at the Newark, New Jersey airport. He claimed that Jerry virtually confessed to killing Paula.
What would you say if I told you I killed someone? Well, I don't know what happened. I just freaked out. I lost it.
Over what?
I need some quick cash, so I swiped the old lady's paycheck.
What are you doing?
Nothing.
Why are you in my mother's drawers?
I was just looking for a lighter.
Wait. Wait! These are her papers, and I saw you put something in your pocket. Are you trying to rip her off?
No.
Then let me see what's in your pocket.
No.
Let me
Don't
see
touch
what's
me.
In your pocket.
Get out of my place!
Show me! You liar!
Shut up! I didn't mean to hurt her. Broke her neck.
Look, man, if you've done something like that, you're not getting in my car, and you're not coming back to my place. You got it? I scared you. I'm just kidding.
The witness was very surprised when he learned that Paula had been murdered.
You should have seen your face.
After 7 years, I believe that Jerry has decided that he's no longer wanted or that we're no longer looking for him. And he's able to roam the streets freely without worry of being arrested.
But the 7 years since Paula Pasiak's murder have been filled with pain for her mother, Barbara. In that time, Barbara has seen her own life gradually unravel.
I've become a very angry, very hateful person. Oh, your life is never the same. Part of you dies.
Update, British Columbia, Canada. On October 21st, 1993, Jerry Gervasoni was arrested in the small community of Salt Springs Island where he had been living under the assumed name Gordon McIntyre. When our program aired in Canada, Gervasoni's former landlord recognized him and immediately called authorities.
I come home and sit down to dinner about 9:30, quarter to 10, and flip on the TV, and there was this black and white photo of Gordon McIntyre, my tenant.
Once in custody, the suspect vehemently insisted that he truly was Gordon McIntyre, but fingerprints soon confirmed that he was, in fact, Gerald Gervasoni. At the local airport, Gervasoni tried to avoid photographers as he was hustled onto a waiting airplane. He was then flown to a deportation hearing in Victoria, Canada. Gervasoni will be held there pending extradition to Florida, where he will face charges in the murder of Paula Pasiak. Join me next time. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery.